I was the president of DCIA, and I think I remember that you were there. Okay.
On the table,
you mean at like
there
a one of the lunches?
There are people on your table who have been tapped as leaders just to keep the conversation going and to read the question. The audio will be recorded, so please just start talking. Identify yourself first so that the transcriber can identify your voice. Speak up. It's a pretty good microphone, but of course, project. So I guess just a little introduction.
Is someone order?
Gina Valentine is from Denver. And we are, Gina and I started the Blackhand Tables in 2005 at Scott Haven. We've since done it on video chat with Black grads.
No.
We were really interested in cross-pollinating between the different communities that we're involved in the triangle area. So we just kind of hung out and we were teaching at UNC in Temple and helped in academia. We're also artists, so we have a side of our thing and we're activists. And I feel like there's a lot of people that should be
Yeah, and I think for me too, just it's awesome to see so many people that I know across different communities. And so this is kind of a dream to like have all these really amazing, smart, interesting, like really motivated and dedicated people to the movement all together in one space and have a conversation and to see how it goes. So really this is not about planning or trying to have a kind of goal that's practical, but really about archiving a conversation and seeing where we're at this moment in time, post-Ferguson or in this post-Ferguson moment, and again across these disciplines and across communities to really see where we're at. So again, don't feel like you have to speak with a real intentionality around like, well, this is what we should do or this is what should happen, but really a kind of brainstorming and kind of like, this is how I'm feeling now and this is where we're at and this is what I've been doing and this is what I think we should do. So it should be real casual and just really, again, a sort of moment to kind of reflect and have a piece of that moment recorded and archived.
So thanks to Bayou Cafe and to you and Holly, we'll have the recorders, and once those are turned on, you guys can go ahead and the leaders can take the part out of the notebook and start a conversation.
Yeah, and feel free to.
So there's a lot of cards here.
Don't feel
like you have to get through them all. Day, you can go
But did you put them in a priority or you just put them in here?
Yeah.
Okay, so the group gets to decide what the priority is.
Yeah, the group
decide
what's important to discuss. Or if you get through one, great. If you get through all of them,
yeah, there's no
seconds.
Way.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's a lot of cards here.
One more answer.
You can cover two. You can cover one.
So I would like to read the questions because otherwise I'm going to choose my own priority. I'm going to be honest, and that's not real democratic of me. So so the first one is, so just, you know, think about it for a minute. The first one is, how do we...
Would it be okay if we do, like, just introduce each
other? Oh, yeah, we could do that. That would be, make sense. I feel, there's a lot of cards here, so I feel
You're
lost.
Like, we gotta get through it.
I mean, yeah. So my name is Nia Wilson. I live here in Durham. I'm a mom. I'm an artist. I'm the executive director of Spirit House, which is a local organization here that does cultural arts and organizing. And I got the cards.
On a side note, I did the logo for that.
Did you do the logo?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we still have it. We still use it.
Spirit House.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I did not know that. There's my piece of history.
Ginger Gresham Cunningham. I'm the senior pastor at Pilgrim United Church of Christ. Do a lot with social justice action. I was the one privileged to officiate 11 weddings the day that we had equal marriage in North Carolina. So they're sort of buried all over the map. Mixture of things. Old dancer.
My name is Andre Leon Gray. I'm a visual artist. I'm based in Raleigh, and I've been professionally exhibiting since 1997. And I'm currently in the Area 919 show at the National Museum here in Durham.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
I'm Elizabeth Pavis, and I'm a professor in the geography department at UNC. And I guess where my interest intersects professionally is that we're just trying to connect our department with a lot of the activism happening on campus around Black Lives Matter, just and a lot about how we represent the community on campus. And one of the interesting things for us has been that the building that we're housed in is called Saunders Hall, and it's named after the founder of the KKK in North Carolina. So we've been doing a lot of organizing around.
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Our building is called Saunders Hall, and it's named after the founder of the KKK in North Carolina.
I thought you said that, and I couldn't comprehend that. Okay.
Yeah, and so there's been, over the years, lots of efforts to try to change the name.
Okay.
And I think with this particular political moment, there's a lot of mobilization and maybe a chance for a renewed discussion about it. So
okay.
We've been active there. And just thinking about how we're inscribing race and value in the landscape itself.
My name is Erin Breed, and I live here in Durham. I'm a photographer, and I'm in school, and I've been studying systemic trauma, or systemic harm as it manifests as trauma through the education system. I've been working. My background as an educator has primarily been in like after school spaces and also in elementary school. So, I'm excited to be
here. Daryl Atkinson. Activist who uses the law as one of many tools for social change. Work at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Lead up our criminal justice reform work where we're focusing on ending the drug war and mass incarceration one brick at a time. I'm a formerly incarcerated person. I spent almost 4 years in prison in the Alabama Department of Corrections for first-time nonviolent drug crime. So, and I don't mean this in any disrespect. This is not something I study. This is my life.
Now I remember our conversation. My little cousin was in Montgomery in prison because I'm from Birmingham.
That's
new. I was trying to remember. But that's what it is.
Okay. Hi. We just went around and introduced ourselves. So.
Thank you. Oh. Leonida Hinge, and I live in Durham. Decided to be here, I guess. I am. Sorry that I'm late. Today is a very important day, though. I take my high school senior to the airport. He had a flight leaving at 1, so we had to kind of be, it was just weird. I couldn't leave him there by himself. So he he's going on a college visit. They're flying him there. So that's like, wonderful. So you have to get him. You have to go off, go to that. So it's just kind of like dropping your kid off, sending him off to college already before he graduates from high school. So anyway, I don't know what you're saying. Your introduction.
That's fine.
That's fine. Next.
You can breathe.
Okay.
You got yourself something to eat. So, like I said, there's a lot of questions here. So I will just read them, and we can sort of decide which is the first one that we want to tackle. So the first one is, how do we sustain the Black Lives Matter movement momentum? Bunch of blanks. Discuss the war on drugs as a factor in heightened policing of non-white and poor communities. Ding, 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 one of my favorites. Redistricting, new voting laws and MC that disenfranchise poor and blacks. Okay. Define criminal and what is the purpose of incarceration. Ding, ding, ding. Artists who co-opt aspects of Black culture for personal gain and their silence on these issues. Iggy Azalea. I just feel like that was the question directed towards her. Black male drivers in Durham are 105% more likely to be searched after a stop than their white counterparts. Durham's 37% Black population accounts for 80% of total traffic stops. Discuss restorative justice. Offenders make amends to offended parties as an alternative to punitive justice. Discuss possibilities of unarmed mediation in our communities, i.e. community watch versus police involvement. Like, facilitator, stop making faces. Discuss differences between protests in the mid-20th century versus today. Does decreased vulnerability to violence equal empowerment? Discuss ways to keep money in Black communities in relationship to trends in gentrification. Black Lives Matter should prioritize structural reform over justice for individual families. Implicit unconscious bias is the, I don't know what that word is, a priori or custom, the norm. How do we cultivate new norms? I don't know the word, but I understand custom.
Another tense.
Discuss how decriminalization of minor offenses would impact local communities. Discuss differences and similarities between your neighborhood and Michael Brown's. Is the U.S. economy dependent upon its prison system? That's the last one.
Is the U.S. economy dependent?
Dependent on its prison system.
Well, that's an easy yes or no question.
There you go.
Oh,
answer, yes.
I next think question.
So, yeah, so those are the questions. I think a lot of them overlap. And I'd love to know what folks feel are priorities. For me, it's definitely about the criminalization of people and communities, and the drug war and how it's all connected. Anyone else?
Which was the one about, you said something about, I don't know if it's a community gentrification or something like that. I forget.
About Mike Brown's neighborhood?
I think it was near that one, but I think it was a little different from that.
There was one about money and spending money.
Yeah.
How decriminalization of minor offenses would impact.
No, there's one actually that's about economics and gentrification, I think.
It was towards the end.
discuss the ways to keep money in Black communities in relation to trends in gentrification.
That's the one I love. Thank you. Because it just seems that, you know, I've lived that ever since I moved to Durham, you know. So maybe I've been here, you know, over 10 years now. And, you know, I know, we talk to your parents and grandparents, you know, even though we live in a different part. We're originally from Mobile, Alabama. But when you grow up in places, and then whenever I say that, they're like, you lived in like Alabama? I was like, yeah, you live in North Carolina. I mean, like, really, what is, it's not that much, or maybe they're from the Midwest, whatever. They look at Alabama like so bad, so awful, but, and I was just say, well, in that part of the Deep South, you know, I guess some Black communities had to be strong. You had to be strong. You had to live in a certain, since you lived in a certain area, and that means everybody still shopped where they shopped. It seems like everybody was some type of entrepreneur. Everybody had something to trade or barter. Anyway, I saw strength in that. And then even today, like, one of my sisters still lives there. And, you know, that's just how you live. I mean, it's, but it shows, it's a lot of strength, I feel, in the community. But then in Durham, that seems to be changing a whole lot. So in a way, I moved to an area where I was hoping, you know, that the strength continues there, because it's definitely a very clear, you know, historically neighborhood of color, and that's near North Carolina Central University. Like, still that area, you know, where there are mines growing, you know, hopefully there's more entrepreneurship. But, I mean, gentrification is moving rampantly through part of Durham. I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm going to not be able to live here, because I'm definitely not, I mean, I'm not against, you know, definitely mixed race neighborhoods. That's sometimes when I talk, people talk about gentrification, that's not what I'm totally talking about. I'm talking about when people purposefully outprice the residents there. I mean, like, it's different for anybody of any race or nationality moving into a neighborhood, helping to rebuild it even in some ways. It's these little prong things that I keep saying I'm gonna buy when I go to the flea market in Raleigh, like to pick up trash, because I was like, that's gonna be my job, that I'm just gonna walk up and down my street picking up trash, because that's what I, when I drive in my street, I just want it to look a certain way. And I know there are a lot of college students that park all through there, and they throw trash, and garbage trucks zoom by on pickup days and trash. I was like, so maybe that would be my job. The loose parts, you know, it's just like trying to, you know, I don't know how to do it necessarily, but I really want my neighborhood to be strong and still actually majority of color in some way.
And everybody has a role.
Everybody has a role. I mean,
Let's see if there are anyone else who has something that they feel strongly about.
Well, about that topic.
Growing
up in Raleigh, I noticed as a kid there were more Black-owned businesses like convenience stores, barber shops, especially around Shaw University. And what I've noticed through the years that the ownership has left. Like, also a lot of property where I live. I'm basically in the original house where I grew up. My mother passed away a few years ago, so I inherited the house. So I'm in the neighborhood where I grew up. So I've seen a lot of changes. And what I've noticed is a lot of property around has been rental property. So if people don't own the house, somebody who lives, say, in Maryland somewhere, they want to turn a profit, they'll gut out the house. What I've noticed down the street, they gut the houses out, they were renting out to lower income people. And now these people come in, I think there's an architect down the street now, and it looks like he's building like his own office in the back. So I've noticed that where it's changed in that sense, where people who couldn't afford to buy a house are being moved out because they were renting their property. And at one point, the city of Raleigh did something where they forced people who were sitting on property that was like vacant to inspect it and fix it up. And so that kind of created impetus to change it and gentrify in that sense as well, to bring other people into the community as well.
So I wish there was some kind of rule, because I've driven through a part of southeast Raleigh. I can't think of the name of the community center. I don't know Raleigh that well.
Or?
I just know there's an area where I see all these like beautifully colored townhouses that have like just been.
That's where the projects were. They replaced them. It was the Hope for project, I believe. And I remember I lived across the street. I remember seeing a city sweeper come by like late at night, like, why are they cleaning the street now? That's when like somebody from the presidential administration was coming through to. Because it's basically government property. Mm. I didn't realize this as a kid until I saw a sign that says, no trespassing property is government. Then they changed it over to like town loans. And a stipulation for that is that you couldn't have anybody in your family who was like a. Who was a felon had a criminal record to be able to move back into these townhomes they were building. And the same thing they did with the Heritage Park over by the Mordecai area, the same thing. They moved everybody up. So basically they moved people out to the suburbs like night, day, or window. And that's the thing that's happening around as well, like all over the country.
But you know how some people say, you know, marching and protesting works? Well, I think sometimes change in policy and laws work, you know? And I wish that there was some kind of way that there could be some kind of municipal legislation, I guess, per city or whatever, that, you know, whatever kind of upgrade you want to do to your property, like, you cannot outprice, you know what I'm saying, like, people who've been living there 20, 30 years, you cannot out-tax them just because you built a McMansion on the corner. And that's happened through down Holloway Street. Like, oh my goodness. Like, one of my girlfriends, they just barely were able to get a house in the area. And they had to move and they needed a property. And they got this nice, you know, they've been fixing this two-story house. And I think they probably got it for like $60,000 or $70,000 and fixing it up. And she called me screaming because in just 2 years, two blocks down the street, they're posting a house smaller than theirs for like $250,000. I mean, she was like, oh my God, we're not going to be able to live. I mean, just that quick, 2 years. And it's like, should that even be allowed? Like, maybe there's, and I guess it's not against the law, but maybe it should be somebody to say, in order to keep, like, maybe, you know.
It's a problem with the condos.
I just
too.
Wish you could not
affordable housing.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the way that even that we're talking about, you know, the way that of course it is about policies, but the way that policies are being shaped that actually are displacing people from their neighborhoods and their homes. And the vehicles that are being used. I think one of the things that that we talk a lot about is how, for instance, in order to change the neighborhood so that people are able to come in and purchase up the properties that have been abandoned or dilapidated, you know, there's this push through using like the police and different things to actually get people out. So gentrification doesn't just happen the way that we think it just happens.
Right.
This idea of, oh my God, all of a sudden my neighborhood changed is actually not a reality. And so the vehicles that are being used to make that happen are the same vehicles that are being used across the country. And although in this moment, this Black Lives Matter moment, we're talking about things like people being killed by the police, that's actually only one component, and there are many others that we actually never take a look at around how the Durham community in these neighborhoods that may have, for instance, looked exactly like Mike Brown's neighborhood now look like they do in Durham. And the last stronghold in Durham is the Haytaya area.
Yeah.
And you know, I know the people in that neighborhood who have been fighting to retain that neighborhood for several years. I don't know that they're going to be able to do it.
It's too close to downtown.
Well, it is, and there's, I just wanted to sort of put that to kind of mix that conversation up a little bit and talk about how it happened. And, you know.
Could you talk a little bit more about what that community is doing, you know, if they're, how are they finding or identifying really specific places to try to protect their community? Who are they talking to? You know, is it about turning inward and trying to keep the community really vibrant, or is it about fighting against developers or public policy or codes, or do you have an idea about that?
I mean, I don't have a lot of specifics, but what I know is that fighting against developers or code, by the time you get to that point, it's done. done because the developers have already decided that they want that space and it's theirs. So by the time that folks actually realize that something needs, that's why I'm saying what I'm saying about the vehicle that is used to actually get the developers to the point that they're already there where you might be fighting them. And in the interim, there's all these other things that happen beforehand to clean up your neighborhood and to get rid of a certain population that oftentimes the people who live in that neighborhood have participated in because they don't know any other way of changing their neighborhood. And then the developers come, openly come, because they were already there. And so, you know, those fights down at the city council meeting when the budgets are being approved, that's all, it's done. There's nothing that you can do at that point.
I've said on boards, though, we're working for affordable housing, trying to make sure that the developers don't even have, you know, affordable housing within the condos and the buildings. And it is, I mean, it is too thin.
What's affordable housing?
And affordable housing is much smaller than the rest of the place. It's really, it's not equitable at all. And it does feel like being overrun by money and by choices that are way outside of the people's hands.
I mean, for me, fundamentally, is who are we choosing to invest in?
Yeah, of course.
Because for those folks who want to develop properties, they're given a litany of incentives to be able to come do that. And that's an investment. Mm-hmm. And we're making a choice. And when I say we, I'm speaking collectively, right?
Sure.
Of our governmental bodies are making a choice to invest in those folks.
Right.
But imagine if they took those same resources and invested that same amount of money in those communities to give those people what they need. And so fundamentally, it's a choice that you don't matter. The people who are there, you're not important to us. You don't have the same kind of value as these folks are going to come. And, you know, I know exactly where you're talking about in Raleigh. I'm a deacon in my church, and my church is in Raleigh. And I do some of my sick and shut-in visits right over there. And I could see, there's a lady, this Patricia Buffalo before she passed, and we would see these brightly colored houses like, oh, that's a new one, you know, because they stand out, right?
Right.
And how what used to be a police substation that would park in that vacant at the end, you know what I mean, that big, it almost looks like a big 18-wheeler, if you will. It was a mobile substation.
Right.
That's not there anymore. The more brightly colored homes you get, right?
Right.
Because they don't need
that
for the white people.
Right.
We need that for, you know, the other folks.
Right.
So fundamentally, it's about who matters in this society and who we want to invest in and who has value.
You know, and back when I like to talk about gentrification and housing is because, and I like mixed gentrification because, you know, when you segregated in a certain way, you can have neighborhoods where you know just where to target who you think is a criminal. You know what I'm saying? Once you have created a wall around, and they know, the police know just where to hang out, just where to intimidate, just where to target and look like. Those boys don't like, they have to know, you know, they could just be walking to the store. But I'm just saying, when you start, I guess moving people out because of bad gentrification and closing them, you know, pushing them, you know just where to go. I mean, they're right there. It's like I said, like crabs in a barrel. I mean, and that's where, you know, where crime, you know, not where crime is, but that's where you go look for crime. Sometimes even when you're looking for something, you're gonna find. So you should have seen how I even tried to cover my tags before I got, you know, I was like, oh man, I got to go get my plates renewed. I'm like, well, I could easily get pulled over and take, I mean.
Certain neighborhoods.
Certain neighborhoods that you just sit and look for that, you know, and you don't get the benefit of the doubt that whatever.
Well, I think a really good example from what I know of what we're talking about is what happened in the South Side. Right? So that's why I was saying that it all happens way before the development. So the South Side neighborhood is a working class African American neighborhood of the folks who worked at the tobacco warehouses right there. At one point in time, that was definitely a vibrant African American neighborhood that got that the city divested or disinvested, whatever the word is, decided to stop investing in that community. And so the community ultimately became this community that seemed to be high crime and, you know, high unemployment and high drug traffic area and all of that. And it was that when I moved, I've been here for 16 years, when I moved here, you didn't go to the South Side. You know, you didn't go to the South Side. But that wasn't because the people, many of the people and the families, and some of them are renters, but they're still renters from black landlords. So it was still a black, a neighborhood that was primarily black owned. As then there became this moment when somehow somebody wants that property. Well, we now have American Tobacco, right? So you can walk to the Bull Stadium, you can walk to American Tobacco. Somebody wants that neighborhood. And the people who have lived in that neighborhood all their lives, because many of the people who are there are families who have lived in that neighborhood for 40, 50 years, 60 years, grew up in that neighborhood, also want better for their neighborhood because the neighborhood had been disinvested from the city, so all these things were happening. So them working together with the developers who now want the neighborhood ended up taking over that neighborhood. Right? So then, and then the city does this thing where they're like, oh, we're going to offer all this job training program to these people who, there are so many issues that the neighborhood is dealing with that a job training program is not going to then lift people up out of poverty. Just because you offer a job training program, and then often in these programs, most of the people in the neighborhood don't make it through because they have so many other things to deal with. So there's actually no real investment in the people in that neighborhood. But the city can say, well, we offered them these things, right? And then they're, everyone's moved out. People's houses are taken away from them through the code. People use the coding to get, people lost their homes when their own neighbors were calling the city to come and check for code violations. And that's how they lost their homes. Or the city offered them $5,000. And this is all the dirty stuff that people don't know that's now being reported. People lost their family homes because somebody, one of their neighbors called on them. And then the developers have moved in. Now the neighborhood is split, right? So on Enterprise Street, on this side of Enterprise, is all those new homes that look beautiful. It's a white neighborhood. They've actually got their own neighborhood association now. And then on this side of Enterprise are the black folks that are still trying to retain something, which is where the police are still circling. Homes are being taken, and it's all happening right underneath our nose. But this was, you know, this, it didn't just happen. And that was a decision that was made by some of the neighbors, the community members who lived there, in order, because they wanted their neighborhood back that they grew up in, and the developers who wanted that space. But it's because there was never any investment in those people. It was a way, and it takes how many years? How many years does it take to do something like that? 30? You know, it takes that many years to make the neighborhood go from being a vibrant African-American neighborhood to now one that has been completely gentrified, and most of those people not only don't have jobs, they didn't have the proper education that they needed, they've been in and out of prison, so they can't get jobs, and all that happened while there was this disinvestment happening. That's the way that they stopped investing in the community. And so, you know, I don't think that there is any such thing as a good gentrification, because I believe that it's just about takeover, and that people sit and wait for 30, they have the time to wait. And it's actually intentional, and it's very strategic. And while it's happening, people are being criminalized and being killed, and the system is using the police force to clean it up. Not because they care, but because somebody wants
because
the property.
They can.
Right, because they can. And that's what happened to the South Side. It's what's happening to East. Now you know. Those are my favorite things. She knows that.
Has anybody ever done any research or reading on the origins of police and militias, and where that even birthed from, and the original intent is to protect property owners, predominantly white property owners. and how property rights were elevated over human rights, and that we need this group of folks to make sure that these other people feel very safe and secure in the acquisition of their property and maintaining their property and having their stuff, right? Police is, you know, it has a certain function, and today that function is the same. And what I'm interested in discussing is us really, because it's easy for us to sit around here and intellectualize and eat our lunch and talk about the bad, bad city council and the developers, right? I think what is more challenging is to look at our own complicity in this system and how, and I'll give you a case in point. I'm sure everyone has been, whether it's to DPAC or to a ball game or to a restaurant right in the area, and they enjoy their time there, right? And every weekend, to ensure that folks like us can enjoy our time there, the police department goes and massively sweeps up the homeless population. So we aren't bothered with poor people begging us because they don't have a fair shake and equal opportunity in this country to be able to make it, right? And so to protect our privilege, so we can watch our ball games and drink our beers and sit out on the sidewalk at Revolution and have our nice meals. You know, they do this massive sweep of poor folks and they lock them up so they are invisible and they aren't seen. So we don't have to be flustered at all, right, while we're enjoying our good time. And that's just one example, but I bet if we did a searching inventory, we could find example after example after example of how we ourselves, the so-called left intelligentsia, right, is right complicit in the very stuff that's happening to poor folks and black and brown people in Durham, in Raleigh, and all around the country. So how do we take ownership and stop that, you know? Because it's easy to point the finger at other people.
I appreciate my friends that are in East Durham, who a couple that started neighborhood like gatherings, getting everybody to bring potluck, started just by community, building back the community after people had been so hurt and worn down and wounded. And they say, you know, this is seems like a small thing, but it's been an amazing thing to help people find a connection where they could unite together differently. So I know lots of different people who do just that, their role. They do their role.
We do that.
And we have to do our role. But it's a small thing, but it's a something that everybody has to do. Yesterday I was at the State House with 100 clergy, and we almost got arrested.
I heard.
For trying to take letters to our representatives to say, here's the deal. You know, look at where people are voting, how they're being moved. Look at the fact that family of four with $250,000 a year will get a tax cut. A family of four with $20,000 a year will have to pay more taxes. That's what it says. And it was a horrible experience. We were Christians, we were Jews, and we were Muslim all together there. And they tried to arrest all of us at one time. But the people there are each doing something. And everybody's got a role.
I made some t-shirts. I know it's so crazy. I had one of my friend's daughters kind of help me design a t-shirt. And I only could afford like 10. I bought 10. You know, I mean, I literally went online, uploaded them. And I said, I'm going to get more and maybe even try to sell them and then use the money like to help even just friends like get their kids in college. I mean, it's just totally like, what can I do for that? But the t-shirt just says, you know, are you a dream crusher? That's all it says. So that's my motto. And it's just asking people a question. And I tell my children, if somebody looks at your shirt and like, what does that mean? I said, they're a crusher. They're probably a crusher. You know, they don't even know it, you know. But if somebody looks at it and say, ah, I get it. So then, yeah, we got to get them a t-shirt, you know. So that's the little thing. But I'm a journalist, and I always try to think of examples, like the smallest example, like to, what could I do to try to change? And so a story that I'm working on now is how, because we all know, you know, people talk about, you know, how do you help I guess, bring up kids in a way that maybe they love education and maybe they'll continue on and maybe they won't falter or fall off. Because, you know, you look at a lot of people who are incarcerated, you know, they fell off the education wagon somewhere too early.
They get pushed off.
Well, that's why I have a dream crusher.
Did they fall off?
I have two black boys, so that's why I have my dream crusher shirt. The system failed them. And then I'm doing a story. I think I'm working on a story about how the system is failing. Because, you know, they always say start them off early. You know, I remember when I talked to my parents when they started. What is the smart, not smart start, but
Head Start.
So, you know, Durham has two Durham Public Schools, Montessori Magnet Elementary Schools, that people fight to get in because it starts at 4. That means your child gets to be in kindergarten for 2 years. Now, if you can't think a child will get a good start if they can be in kindergarten for 2 years with the same teacher, then you are mistaken, because my boys made the lottery to get into one of those schools. Well, he actually didn't make the lottery. He was waitlisted because it's so competitive to try to get those little slots. Well, the problem is now that as they started renovating, as Trinity Park, you know, those houses are just like you can't even afford to live there now, because that Watts Elementary School was turned into one of those early pre-K. So you have wealthy people who are getting their kids a free, pretty much, education because they live in walking proximity to that school.
And I was in the fight for this. This is what I want to go back to, like, by the time that the decision is made before the community conversation happens.
But now it's a major, because see, a lottery is countywide. It should be countywide, but they got the rules changed. The Trinity Park folks say, no, we should have a walking, the walking rule. I wasn't a walking rule when I applied for that lottery.
Well, I wasn't. I lived there too. My son was supposed to get on the school to go to school across town when we could walk down the street to get him to school before it became a Montessori magnet school. And so it's again about who matters, who's invested in it. And when that fight happened in front of the school board, by the time the fight around making it a Montessori school happened, it was a done deal.
I'm fighting. You know, in my as a journalist, just all I can do is expose, and the wrong children are benefiting from that education and that Head Start. Like,
but they made that decision. I remember the school board meeting when a woman stood in the school board meeting and said, when all the black and brown families stood in the school board meeting and were complaining about them doing this, people from EK Poe were complaining about the fact that all the students were then going to overcrowd their school, and we were threatened to be thrown out of the school board meeting. And this woman who was pregnant, she wasn't even a parent, her child wasn't even born yet, this white woman who lived in Trinity Park, and she was pregnant, and she said something about her not wanting to have to send her kid to private school when it was old enough to go to school. And Ann Denlinger, who was the school board president at the time, said, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you.
Really?
While we were being threatened to be thrown out, our children were in elementary school, and there were all these parents that were there, and that was when this decision was made. It was already a done deal. And so you can't, you know, in this moment, after the fact, it was a done deal. They wanted the school. They wanted it in walking distance. They didn't want their children to have to. They didn't want to have to pay for private school. And so it was taken. And so, you know,
there's some, I guess, new people on the school board. There's some policy being circulated. They're really, I guess, they have the numbers to now prove how wrong. What, you know, the repercussions of that. So really, you just
but in that moment,
I know it was awful.
They've always had access.
Isn't that awful?
There's always numbers.
Which, you know, that's what I'm saying. You stop educating what that whole program was set up to do, and now they're looking at the numbers and like,
well, they knew that.
And also, I know, like what Daryl was saying about like the construction of police and that industry, the education system too was established on like kidnapping indigenous kids and bringing them into colonial schools and teaching them English and teaching them European value systems. So it's like we're still working with this system that is like established in like, you know, colonial genocide, and it's continuing to happen, but it just keeps like the facade of it just keeps shifting. And when that facade keeps shifting, and it's like we're not actually like like communities aren't actually able to like manifest like structures like of that are self-determined and like centered in like values that that community is collectively establishing, like kids aren't going to be able to ever learn in the spaces that like we hope and wish they could. And like, I think part of this conversation too is like gentrification, like when we talk about gentrification, like why it's just like it's colonization, and it just keeps happening, and like
right. Use the real world. The real world, rather.
And privatization, too, because suddenly that school becomes a private school.
Yes, that's exactly what it's
linked to the property value.
And you know, it's so crazy. When I moved, we moved here from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I heard about Moorhead Montessori Elementary School, and there was just a little bitty raggedy house. None of the houses are raggedy. They've told them that neighborhood, too, has been... So it was a little yellow, raggedy, two-bedroom house. I was like, we're going to rent this house because I know Durham has the 0.5-mile rule. If you live in 0.5 miles next to a school, you get to go to that school. And then when I went downtown, they were like, not that school, honey. You know, they were like, you have to put your name in the lottery, and we will see, but the odds are not good. And I was like, you mean I moved here? Because I thought I could. I mean, literally, I thought that was the rule. And then when I found out it wasn't, I still put my name in the lottery. And of course, like I told you, we didn't get in, but then we were on the waiting list several weeks later because some people who just don't show up. But then why I moved is because the neighborhood just started changing, and it got, I guess, more Caucasian. A lot more people with little bitty children, because they changed the rules so they could, that point, they did change it to the 0.5 walk rule. That's why Trinity Park and Watts is. And I was like, you know what, I'm moving. And that's when I moved close to North Carolina Central. I said, my boys, we don't need to live in this neighborhood anymore. I said, they need to see kids that not only look like them, kids going to school, big kids going to school. I mean, literally, I was like, I'm moving. And I moved. I mean, just for that, I didn't want to live near Moorhead anymore.
This is so hard because I live in a very eclectic neighborhood. I like my eclectic neighborhood. And when we first moved here about 7 years ago, there was a house that we loved on Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And we intentionally chose not to live there because we didn't want to be seen as people who were trying to come in and do that. And it was such a hard thing for my sense of, I've always lived in diverse communities. And, you know, to try to find a place that didn't have just all white people, but I wasn't invading all white people, was really a struggle. I mean, it was a kind of like, okay, where do you go where you actually are part of a community and you need to be part of a community where you're not, you know, facilitating this whiteness, or you're not infiltrating this community that wants to be seen. It's hard work.
Now it would be just lucky to move there. I mean, I'm just saying, even the student body of North Carolina Central has changed. I mean, it's more diverse than it was a decade ago.
I want to kind of go back to something that you had touched on about the public-private dichotomy and how we feed into it. I don't say this with any recriminations at all, because I have a 2.5-year-old. When she's of school age, I want her to have the best possible choice to get the best education. So I get it why people go and participate in the lotteries. I get it. They want the best thing for their child. But in many ways, that gives life to the ability to create this kind of second-class status of the good schools and the bad schools, right? The private schools, the quasi-private, being that they're magnet, and we're going to invest in additional resources, and then in the public schools. Mm-hmm. And right now, we all know what that is dog whistle language for, right? The public schools. And going back to history once again, where did the institution of public schools even begin? is post-Reconstruction, when black lawmakers had acquired some power and they knew that all these free black folks that had been, it had been made criminal to educate them, they needed to have education. So let's institute a public education system. And what our opposition has done very well, they are have a very intentional, disciplined march to delegitimize everything in the public space. Government can't do anything well, public schools is bad, public health care is bad. Now they even move into public prisons are bad, right? Everything public is bad. To privatize everything.
That's scary.
And what does it end up doing? It leaves the least of these, right, who are predominantly African-American, Latino, and poor white folks, it leaves them on the lower end of the spectrum where they never are going to catch up. And that's purposeful, right? So once again, I'm going to pivot. Our own participation within these structures and systems, right? And unless we are either swimming against the stream or trying to disentangle or dismantle these systems, we're merely participating and giving their hegemony even more power.
I agree with that, but then like my question is like, where is the boundary between like we're participating in this and like we're being what do we consent to and like what are we engaging in because like there isn't another option.
And I think that's an excellent point, Aaron, but can we create some other options?
Well, right, and I'm asking.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, is should our energies be focused on trying to internally reform corrupt systems, or should our interests be focused at developing our and developing new systems and structures that work for us?
You know where my vote is.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's just like, how do, like, what has to like be cultivated in order to do that, and it's just like, and I think that like Harm Free Zone is a project of that, and like, and like what Fade Work is doing to like, you know, like push back on like criminalization and just like really like allowing community folks to like engage in like deeper unpacking of like all the situations and experiences that people have gone through to like get to this situation that, you know, like they were in some ways, you know, kind of just like pushed into, but like how does that happen around, how do we do that around like childcare and youth development and like in healthcare? And I think, I don't know, and so I think that it's a big question.
No, it's a huge question.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't have a holistic, total answer, but I'll give one, you know, historical example of how even the government borrowed from community and genius to institutionalize something, and you brought it up in Head Start. Head Start really was the government fighting from the Black Panther Party and their breakfast club.
Yeah.
That was community-based Head Start.
Well, and that's what restorative justice is now too. You know, it's like they're like fighting that stuff back, and so like it's just like,
I don't know. But,
so I have this moment. I had this conversation this morning. I was posting about this on Facebook. So where I'm really something you said, and now it's trying to. Kind of escaped me, but this idea that poor people, for instance, are ever going to make it right out of poverty to middle class, and I don't want to say this as some like Debbie Downer, right? But I mean as a block, right? So we'll say as a block. So I'm not talking about individuals or the fact that individuals need to, you know, find work and this and that, and maybe change their status in life. But as a block, because of capitalism, there has to be poor people. Right? I mean, there's going to be poor people. So as a community, this idea that we have to keep working to get out of it, and we'll do whatever we have to do to get out of it.
And that that's poor, possible.
Right, it doesn't make any sense. Privatizing everything also ensures that we have this block of poor people who believe that they have no value or no power. We have, because I'm poor, and I'm going to continue to say that, have no power, have no value. And so our voice doesn't matter, and all of these things keep happening to us. We have to find a way to, like, to or I don't you know I hate to use the word organized because I'm not trying to be social justice in this moment, but to value these people who are not invested in by the people who have money and who have power, because we've equated power to money, to level of education, to
maleness,
right?
Yeah.
But this is where we're complicit, right? Because we also, there's in some of us, we also have that core belief. And so to me, like when I look at where I'm complicit, that's where I'm like, well, why do I value so-and-so because they have a PhD? Or why do I value so-and-so because they have a good job? When I know that my grandmama knew all of these things that I actually value, that I'm ashamed.
And works hard. But
that I'm ashamed to say in public. Like, right? I can say that for myself, but in public, I'm ashamed to say that actually I learned from my grandmother. Actually, I didn't go to college, and I'm smart as hell, you know? And
some of the best chefs in the world learn that way.
Right, but we don't, so like when I think about how I'm complicit in it, I do take a look at what I value and what I can do to shift our value system away from what the people who want to retain power have deemed to be valuable. And that's where the creation of something different that's led by the people who are not invested in matters.
That's one thing I want to, I can't take sides either way, you know, like on the moral Monday movement, but in a way what I get from what you're saying, to me it is about like morals, like what do you believe in? And for some naive reason, you know, you feel that one person at a time can make someone think a little, because believe me, when I moved to Pico off Fayetteville Street, and that many of my friends of color would never move back to that neighborhood. Never. And I was like, well, somebody's got to move there.
Right.
Yeah. I said, I think we could take that neighborhood back, guys. You know, I think we could, I said, because the property values are going to go nowhere but up. Anyway, you know, I said, why not move? And so it's like this moral, like when I moved to North Carolina and my job was in Chapel Hill, my father was like, you're not living in Chapel Hill. He says, you have to live in Durham. He says, because he started naming his friends that lived in Durham, and he was like, and I know the population and the percentage of people who come. He was like, you have to move to Durham. And I was also kind of raised that, you don't ever send your kids to a school that ends in Christian or Academy. you know why? Because they were all started at the same time by people who refused to integrate the school system. I mean, if you look at the year that all the academy school, you know, Durham Academy, whatever you can choose, I'm not saying all of them, but most of them.
There's a trend.
I grew up knowing, never send my children. So it's like this thing you try to rub off and go one friend at a time, like, you know, you don't send your kid to a school that is, because they never wanted your, you know. And so I don't know what to do about that. I mean, how do you make people, think just a little bit that what goes around comes around, like eventually, you know.
So I would like to be in the queue. We got to do both and. We have to try to minimize the harm as much as we can while we're operating in this crappy system, while imagining something new. And for me,
clearly we work together all the time.
And for me, it is the same issue, right? And King laid it out in his Riverside speech: consumerism, militarism, and racism. We're still dealing with it. And malignant capitalism, it's going to ensure that it's poor and rich. That's how it operates. So until we deconstruct and dismantle that system, we're going to have poor and rich. But I do fundamentally disagree with this pervading idea of scarcity. That there aren't enough, and I gotta hoard, and I gotta get, and I gotta set the rules up so me and my clan can have more. That is a false narrative. We have more than enough. It's just some motherfuckers got too much. And we got to shift that. And we got to reveal those contradictions and win over our brothers and sisters of goodwill to get them to understand
that's
that some people got too much.
Morally, you're trying to like, okay, how can I convince you to give back?
But if you listen to Dr. Barker, the reason he rattles on our Constitution, you may have to help me with it, Daryl, about our Constitution says, first of all, it says it is Christian. So try to appeal to the obnoxious people say that they're a Christian in the government. They were supposed to care for the widows and the orphans and the disenfranchised. You will hear him over and over and over again just state this. Mm-hmm. To call those people to attention to say, no, you're completely hypocritical. You're not trying to care for these people. And every policy you make that disenfranchises somebody, that changes how we vote, that changes who gets a teacher's aide in their class, that changes this or that, is hypocritical to who you say you are. And you know, the
minutes, so if you want to try to wrap up your conversation.
One more thing that's important to me is about those who are formerly incarcerated. Our faith team, there are about 17 faith teams in the area, different faith communities that have someone who's formerly incarcerated who walks with them as a partner as they're kind of being reintegrated into society. So our church is kind of known for sex offenders. So we have had, this is our sixth person who's a sex offender. First of all, it's hard time finding a place to live. Secondly, hard time finding a job. Thirdly, I mean, it's just the community, the family, everybody leaves them. So we're just setting people up to reoffend if we don't try to be there. So our partner texts me every morning, every afternoon. No triggers, no things that's going on. Every day. Has a job now. So because he has a job, they've taken away SNAP and he has to pay child support. Barely has a job. Lives in a group home. So setting him up again to stay at the very bottom rung of the social economic ladder is what continues to happen over and over and over again. That's the system I'm in.
I would encourage you to adopt some different language in referring to, and it's really wordy, but people who are convicted of crimes that require them to be on the registry, because that term is so loaded, it creates such a visceral, oftentimes negative response in people. So people ask me all the time, well, what kind of language should we use there? People who are convicted of crimes, people who have been to prison, people who have to register, but the operative word is people. It affirms their humanity, you know?
I will tell him this too, because we've had to help him change his language, so we'll all work on
it. Right, because we're adopting a language that
has been taught.
Absolutely. Helps us to not see people as humans. We see them as whatever label we put on them. And imagine having to walk with that every day of our lives. And many of us don't have to even think about that.
Right.
Many of us don't think twice about it. And then, you know, my thing is always think about what it would, walk around with that like that, you know, in our performance that we do, our Collective Sun performance, there's a part in the play where we put a sign over top of audience members' head and make them sit through the rest of the performance with this label. And then at the end, ask them what that felt like to have to sit through, to just even sit for an hour with that label as the first thing that people see about you. And how does that shift how you want to look and refer to people who have been incarcerated for, you know, and whose stories are never told.
And this isn't no fuzzy hug-a-thug kind of thing, right?
Hug-a-thug, I like that.
Historically, look at whenever we wanted to colonize, whenever we wanted to dominate, what's the first thing that took place? You had to demonize that group of people. You had to make them less than, right? Savages, jigaboos, whatever, right? And you do that through the language, through the art, through the images that you put forth about a group of people to make them subhuman. Then the legal regime comes in, then the militarization and the violence comes in because you've already debased them to where it's okay to do whatever it is you want to do to them. So it's really the first battleground, right, to affirm humanity. This is a person. This is my brother. This is my sister. And none of us is the sum total of
our actions.
One action, you know?
There was a great class. You know, Canada started the program with COSA like we have in town. And they took with this whole thing about how the label started with, you know, pedophile and the breaking down pedophile between pedophile and child molester, which are actually different things. And then trying to talk about how you continue to break it down further. And the upgrade helped those in the room who have been labeled in such a way, but still the shame on it is so intense that it just brings out the sorrow throughout the whole entire process. And then you start dealing with parents who are liberal and left-minded, but if they know what somebody did, it changes their perspective a lot of times too.
And that's all fear-based, you know? I mean, the other thing that we have to really, right.
That's why I'm proud of my church for not being fear-based.
Yeah, exactly. We have to talk about most of people's interests are, you know, based in like fear of losing, fear of scarcity, fear of harm. It's all fear-based, and that's what motivates us. And if we can have that conversation around, like, you know, again, like how the conversation I had this morning around, like, when we're talking about white people in this moment, was really like, so what is it that's at stake for you? Like, let's talk about what's at stake for you and not what I need you to do because you see this happening to black people. Because that, you're not invested then because of anything that's at stake for you. You're invested at what I'm losing, which is not going to, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. So let's talk about...
What's your skin in the game?
Right. Let's talk about what your fear is, what you're afraid of losing or whatever, what you're afraid of happening, and then build the movement from there. You know, what's at stake?
That seems key because it comes back to the tension that comes out of all of these individual actions when your only option is to take care of yourself and your family and make the...
Right.
There's no social structure to be integrated in. There's no sense of community or even broader structures. Then where do you go?
It's so hard. You should see how I just kind of... Because what was important about my son getting on that plane today, because he's gotten accepted to a lot of schools, and he can go plenty of places, and but the school that sent for him, you know, for him where he's going in New Orleans, is sort of one of our old family schools, and that's Dillard University in New Orleans. And to make my son understand why you almost must go to Dillard, you know, it's like, and it's hard to put that much pressure on a young kid. I was like, it's our duty, honey. And I'm like, that's what we do. That's what we do. I mean, it's no, and he, you know, he's never been in New Orleans before, and he's never. And this is a small little Methodist school, and, you know, it's truly in the hood of New Orleans, you know, and I'm not sure if it's totally revitalized since Katrina. You know, I haven't been there.
So while we're talking about proud parents.
And I'm like, oh, is this a baby?
That's my daughter. She's at last year in J school at University of Missouri.
So he's got a two-year-old and a 20.
That's a good J school.
Oh, yeah. She's interviewing Merle Evers.
Oh, look at Merle.
Oh, cool.
I was trying
that is kind of cool.
Oh my
God. Missouri's a good chase.
So I'm proud of
I was like, somebody's got to go back.
She was the age of.